In the summer of 1985, protesters demanded the government provide jobs for survivors of the tragedy. These protests began a decades-long struggle for justice that continues to this day.
Rashida B., Champa Devi, and their fellow survivor activists had no idea what they were signing up for when they asked a simple question: why are we not paid equally? That snowballed into a decades-long crusade. In order to get equal wages, they had to fight not only cultural barriers, but even the structures that were seemingly set up for them. The Tailoring Skills Center that was set up specifically for gas survivors, the government centralizing claims allegedly for bargaining power, and the political parties who kept promising that they would amplify the survivors' voices.
I don't know if snowballed is the right word, because it implies that life happened to them, when in reality, they seized control of their own lives, overcoming poverty, overcoming patriarchy, overcoming the narrow vision of what they were told their lives could and should be. It all started with a simple question of why, and a simple belief in why not.
When we arrived, the Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi refused to meet with us. So when Rajiv Gandhi won't meet us, we sat under India Gate for 10 days. In those days, there wasn't so much security. We used to eat and sleep and sit there all day and night. And we got to the PM mansion at 2 a.m. one night. That's when we ran into Suresh Pachauri, politician from Madhya Pradesh in and out of Congress, and then said that whatever ask we have, he will fulfill all of them. We said, great, why don't you write it down? And he said, what, you don't trust me? In those days, we were so naive that we believed him. We had never left the house, we weren't educated. So how we were supposed to know that politicians lie? From the day to today, we never saw that man again, let alone got any of his promises fulfilled. A few years later, Rajiv Gandhi came to Bhopal to visit the survivor. And we said to him that we came to see him on foot. And he said he had no idea, no one told me. After he left, Gandhi never looked back. Then Rajiv Gandhi died in his car accident.
But Rashida B. and the others did not give up hope. They decided to try another route, taking their fight into the court system as well.
We went to criminal court, and after 6 years of the case going on, the judge says we were in the wrong court. We need to go to high court. After another 3 years, you are still in the wrong court. You need to go to labor court. So 10 years of our life were just wasted away like this. In the Supreme Court in 2013, we got the decision that we should get rupees 1500 in wages and 2 lakh in lost income extra. So finally we won, but we still have not got full justice.
They finally won almost $3,500 US present day. Rashida B. and the other women started their journey in 1989.
Well, really, they started in 1985, when they began to demand real jobs with decent wages.
And they didn't receive the final ruling from the Indian Supreme Court until 2013. That's almost 30 years of waiting for a verdict.
A verdict as to whether or not being affected by the gas tragedy, which was completely outside of their control, and suffering with its consequences for decades, should keep them from making a living wage.
This is the story of the Bhopal gas tragedy, of the men, women, and children who survived it.
and the decades-long struggle for justice, compensation, and the right to clean drinking water.
This is the story of the Bhopalis who were shaped, but not defined, by the disaster, of hope, of resilience, and of memory.
This is They Knew Which Way to Run. Please note that this podcast contains depictions of death and loss that some people may find disturbing. I'm Molly Mulroy.
And I'm Apoorva Dixit.
Episode 4. We were blinded by the gas. What excuse does the government have? As you probably remember, Union Carbide was an American company. At the time of the tragedy, its president was Warren Anderson. According to the New York Times, Anderson was a carpenter's son who had devoted his life to climbing the Union Carbide corporate ladder, arriving at work at 7 a.m. and frequently moving from city to city. As president and chief operating officer, Anderson ruled over an empire with 700 plants in more than 36 countries. His major concern before the tragedy was disappointing financial results. In 1979, the company had predicted its sales would reach $13 billion by 1983. But in 1983, they were only around $9 billion, and earnings had dropped more than 90%. And then came Bhopal.
The news of the tragedy began spreading immediately. There was no cell phone footage, but plenty of horrifying photos began circulating. Photos of bodies covered in white sheets lined up in the yard in front of the hospitals. Photos of people with eyes wrapped in gauze and clutching their heads. So Warren Anderson came in to assess the damage and offer his thoughts and prayers.
Here's another phone call I had with Apoorva during her first couple months in India.
I mean, that's the American response to any tragedy, you know? You need to have a strong PR front. You need to be there on the ground to be like, yes, we are here supporting the local people or whatever. But the moment he showed up, obviously, it was just such a huge, the scale was just so beyond anything that anybody had imagined. He did not realize how angry and violent that people are about to get.
While Anderson was in India, however, he and UCC realized how bad the situation really was, and he was charged with manslaughter. This was, at the time, shocking. Anderson had only come to India under the assumption that he would be given safe passage. But when he arrived, he was arrested by Madhya Pradesh police and taken to the Union Carbide guest house and put under house arrest. It was clear that he was in danger. Protests were getting violent and officials refused to let him visit the factory when he asked to. Anderson began to realize that he might not be allowed to leave Bhopal and that he might be headed to an Indian prison instead.
In the Union Carbide guest house, it's been reported that there was a landline phone in his room that he used to call the U.S. for help. Who he actually called, we have no idea. The chief minister for Madhya Pradesh at the time was Arjun Singh. Arjun Singh was not even in Bhopal that day. He was at an election rally elsewhere in the state when he received a call directing him to let Anderson go.
The details of this call, and actually, many of the details surrounding what happened with Anderson are still somewhat a mystery. But what we do know is that after only a few hours in the guest house, Anderson paid 25,000 rupees, roughly $450 today, for bond, and was flown to New Delhi and then back to America. As part of his bond, he promised to return to India to stand trial. He never did. What we still don't know about Anderson's story, however, is who gave the official order to let him go. Arjun Singh, the one who received the call to let Anderson go, wrote in his autobiography that it was the Union Home Secretary of India who called him, quote, on the instructions of the then Union Home Minister, his boss. But the Home Secretary claims that he didn't become Home Secretary until 1985, a year after the tragedy.
In my time in Bhopal, I often heard the rumor that the call came straight from the top, that Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi himself intervened. Arjun Singh died in 2011, so that may be one element of the story that we can never truly know. However, this was just one more instance where many survivors believed their government was working more on behalf of America than its own people.
In an interview with the New York Times 5 months after the tragedy, Anderson said that he felt lost and helpless. "You wake up in the morning thinking, can it have occurred?" he said. "And then you know it has, and you know it's something you're going to have to struggle with for a long time."
But Anderson never even showed up to stand trial. And who could make him? The U.S. court that had originally dismissed the case in New York and sent it to India had only given India jurisdiction for the civil case, not the criminal one. Union Carbide maintains that it is not subject to criminal jurisdiction in India and has not consented to it. But India made many attempts to extradite him. With the support of the U.S. government, Anderson escaped extradition by insisting the 1989 settlement with the Indian government ended the chance to prosecute him for anything. He avoided subpoenas for civil cases by changing jurisdictions and moving between his homes in Florida, Connecticut, and the Hamptons. Finally, in 1992, Bhopal officially declared him a fugitive.
For years, there were protests in India to bring Anderson back and make him face justice for what his company had done. Even today, the vehement hatred for Anderson can be felt throughout Bhopal. The phrase "Hang Anderson" became a common slogan people scrawled on the walls of the factory and on protest signs.
I'll never forget what Shehzadi B told me when I asked her about Anderson and the factory. Shehzadi B was my guide along with Nasreen B. She was wise, with a quick laugh that almost hid how fierce she could be.
When I hear factory, I think of the owner. If Warren Anderson appeared in front of me, I feel like I could just drink his blood. If he had not built this factory, this would not have happened to any of us. Gas only leaked one night, but we drank the poison of that factory for 20 years.
This man became a central character in so many survivors' lives. They blamed him, they hated him, and to this day, they remember him in infamy.
The only criminal convictions to come out of the Bhopal gas tragedy were finally made in 2010. 7 middle managers of the Union Carbide factory, all Indian citizens and most in their 70s by that time, were convicted for causing death by negligence. They were sentenced to 2 years imprisonment and fined about $2,500. But all were released on bail soon after the verdict. And Warren Anderson? Nothing. Anderson died peacefully in 2014 at a nursing home in Florida at the ripe old age of 92.
In 1991, around the same time Rashida and the other activists were just beginning their court battle, the Bhopali government started to build a road through Bhopal. In order to do so, they had to demolish many of the slums throughout the city, and particularly around the factory. These were people's homes. Many of the families in these slums had lived there for decades. Their kids had grown up there, they had made their livelihood there, they experienced the gas tragedy there and worked through the aftermath there, together, as a community.
Here is Nasreen B, who served as one of my guides during my research. She was a younger survivor, only a couple of years old when the gas tragedy happened, and she had since grown into a savvy community health worker and organizer. She grew up in the Hamidia slum next to the factory and the iconic Hamidia Hospital, where many gas victims ended up the night of the tragedy and many, many nights after. She and her entire family were moved 15 miles away from their home to make way for what is now known as the VIP Road, a highway to run alongside the big lake of Bhopal. Here she is telling us about the protests that were organized against being relocated.
तब माहौल बहुत खराब था हमारा उस वक्त हम तालाब पे रहते थे तो हमारी बड़ी बहन की शादी हुई थी ऊंचाई पे
The energy was terrible. We were so stressed and sick. None of us had been paid yet for the gas disaster. And there was a lot of poverty in general. We did a lot of protests on the VIP road for 3 days. They bulldozed all of our homes. It was raining so much then. Back then, the new land where they moved us to was all dirt. So all of this flat land had become swampy and crawled with insects. I got stung by a scorpion 3 times, so I was very sick. They broke 700 buildings in my neighborhood. The rest of the people here came from different parts and at different times. One neighborhood came from Barkhedi, another came from Bhopal riots in 92. Most of the people they moved here are gas survivors.
Nasreen B and many activists believed that this was more than just development. They believed the slums were bulldozed intentionally to break up the gas survivor communities, and that these families were moved to the outskirts of town to make it more difficult for them to organize.
Well, what do you think about that?
It's just so difficult to know. But the thing is that they are right. Breaking up these communities had a significant effect on their ability to organize. And around this time, organizing was really starting to ramp up. Because now, more than 7 years after the tragedy, people still had not received any compensation. Income inequality in India looks a lot like how it does here in the US. It is visible, extreme, divisive. And as often the case, the poor did not have the safety net the wealthy did. While the whole of Bhopal was gas affected, the poor were gas and poverty and caste affected. My dad explains it well here.
It's the poor who are real poor, so they work all very hard and they hardly have enough food on the table by the end of the day. And then there's the middle class, which is typically the government employees and people who are not ultra rich, but they are okay. So their kids go to good schools, they are able to educate them. And then there's the rich class, which is people who can do whatever, they can buy whatever. So I kind of fell in the middle, so which is kind of upper, higher middle class, right? But not rich class. In that society, there was not much mention of Bhopal. First off, because there were not many victims from that class of people. Secondly, there was hardly that affected that class. So the poor suffered and poor struggled and poor kind of protested. But the people who were better off, they were hardly even affected, except for probably the long-term effect that happened to them for being in Bhopal. It was never a discussion topic amongst us. I don't remember. Not because we were immune. It was just not a topic of discussion. Hardly ever came about. Initially, like I said, the whole city came to a grinding halt. Then the whole city came together to help. And then after that, the facts of the case, who was right, who was wrong, didn't hear much. My exams for that year were postponed. So that was the direct kind of thing that that affected me.
In fact, life for the middle and upper classes continued on in a lot of ways, as was planned. People who were planning to move, moved. People who were planning to stay, stayed. Buildings that were planned to be constructed were constructed. Here's Apoorva's neighbor, Karan, talking about Judge Colony.
At that time, the house which you are sitting right now wasn't even made that time. This was all a mountain at that time. Nothing, no construction was there at that time. When my grandfather decided to build up a colony here, 500 meters around the house which was given to him by the government officials, as he was the district judge at that time. So that goes to show that even the judges didn't feel that there was some remaining harmful effects in the nearby area, and they were completely okay with building up a huge colony there. Even now, this area is essentially the heart of the city. There have been no effects of this on the surrounding or on the resources, on the water table, etc. There have been no effects of these kind because we drink. There have been bore wells here. We get a water from the nearby lake, which could have been contaminated at them. It was the largest man-made lake at that time, and still people consume water from that lake. So that goes to show that that situation was handled really well by the city officials and everyone. How they didn't let the resources be hampered, and how the new generations don't even feel any effects of it.
Karan is the child of a gas survivor, just like me. He is a proud Bhopali. So is my dad. So is Rashida B. So is Nasreen B. And yet, their memory of the tragedy that devastated their city, that was a global event, their perception of the government is so dramatically different. People in the US often ask me if the gas tragedy is better remembered in Bhopal, if it's just the US that's forgotten. But how can you remember something you were never taught?
While life returned to normal for many people in Bhopal, those most affected were still waiting on compensation. Years went by and they received nothing. They protested and they received nothing. Finally, as we mentioned in episode 3, the news came that the government of India had settled with Union Carbide for $470 million. But that was less than a seventh of the original $3.3 billion ask. So the gas survivors, led by NGOs on the ground, appealed. In 1991, however, the Supreme Court upheld the original settlement, but they did add that Union Carbide would have to pay an additional $17 million to fund a hospital for the victims. The court also ordered the Indian government to purchase, out of the settlement fund, a group medical insurance policy to cover 100,000 persons who may later develop symptoms, and cover any shortfall in the settlement fund.
Now, the question became how to distribute the settlement. Bhopal set up courts where survivors were meant to come, present their case, and claim their compensation. If a family member died, you received a certain sum. If you were affected, you received a different sum. People were classified into grades as to how badly affected by the gas they were. Many survivors were left helpless in the chaos of trying to understand the paperwork they would require to actually receive compensation. They needed proof of identity, proof of address, proof of death, proof of injury, and all kinds of other proofs people did not have, and many could not read, even if they did. After the hurdle of paperwork came the hurdle of making a court date and actually receiving the money. Here again, the wealthier classes were advantaged, and the poor were left vulnerable to exploitation. Here's how my dad remembers it.
So then I went to Pune, finished my studies, worked in Bombay, came back to Bhopal in 1990, started my own business, and then the big event was they'll be distributing some relief. So this is more like 94, 95. They said, yeah, they'll... So not... there was money that was claimed by Government of India because they passed their Bhopal Gas Tragedy Act, but people never saw any money. And so eventually they set up courts to distribute money. And for me being a direct kind of in the line of attack of Bhopal Gas Tragedy, I received initially, I think, 50,000 rupees after... I had to file my paperwork and case, and after probably 95, 96, I got 50,000, which in dollar terms would be $800, $700. And then later on, they had some more money to give out. Overall, as a victim of Bhopal gas tragedy and for the damages suffered, I have received
$1,000. $1,000. That's it. For a chemical leak that turned a city into a gas chamber, that brought about scenes of the apocalypse, that tore apart families and irreparably damaged so many more. For all of these, the survivors received $1,000, at least the ones who actually got their compensation at all.
The survivors are rightfully angry to this day. Bunno B met me in her home, one of the few houses that still has exposed brick. The red of the brick glinted off her henna-dyed hair and black kurta with red embroidery. Here's how Bunno B felt about her compensation.
They gave us a crumb so long ago, 25,000 rupees. First, they only gave us 200. Then they gave us 12,500 and then more. Until finally, they gave us 25,000. What is 25,000? Just $352. The value of a human life is great. It is priceless. Who knows how much a person can earn in a lifetime? 25,000 isn't even enough to run a household. Why did they give us that money? As a loan? They didn't give us our right. Every day we die. We couldn't even see the sunlight for months.
While the actual sum of the compensation felt like a slap in the face in and of itself, the chaos in the distribution of sums was another. Here's Judge Patel describing the courts.
They do not have any law and order. It was a complete chaos, and I was not in favor of them. There was no evidence to back up people's claim. There was no need for witness or anything. So you could receive compensation just by saying that you were affected. There was not even proper distribution of money. There was no inquiry to figure out if people who people say died actually did die. What about the people who actually did die, but there were no records of them? Basically, the problem is that those that were not affected received money and those that were greatly impacted received nothing. The distribution was not fair.
One of the stories I remember very clearly is that of Sushila. I met Sushila Bai in my grandfather's neighborhood in Judge Colony. She worked as a housekeeper in the house down the street. She kept the marble floors shining as she had for decades, working for the same house as it passed from one owner to the next. She had been in Bhopal the night of the gas tragedy, living down the hill, less than 3 miles from the factory. She had stampeded that night, and recalling it still brought tears to her eyes. The injustice that still plagued her most to this day was that committed by a local lawyer, not Union Carbide. Sushila told me of a lawyer who came by to her slum and promised her and her neighbors that he would get them their money. He helped them acquire paperwork, won their trust, but when it came time to actually collect the money, Sushila said that he took their documents, collected money on their behalf, and disappeared. Years later, Sushila found out that he had built himself a nice house in Old Bhopal, and she and her family never saw a single rupee.
There have been more rounds of compensation since the first, and each round has gone on for a while. It's really hard to pin down the timeline for them all. Apoorva asked many people during her research, and they would generally sort of mix them all together when they were talking about them.
Something I do remember, though, is that compensation was still ongoing in 2003. The reason I remember it is because my family lived in India that year. I was in third grade, and I remember playing with all of the other elementary school kids in the neighborhood. There was Rishu Rashi, who lived next door. There was Shilpa, with a parrot down the street. And Adi, across the street, who had a garden full of sweet peas. We left in 2004. When I came back to visit a few summers later, all of my friends had moved away as well.
None of your childhood friends were left?
Very few. It was not until I moved back as an adult to conduct this research that I figured out why so many had left. Their parents were judges that had been brought in to hear the compensation cases, and they were all renting homes in Judge Colony. The reason they had all left by 2006 is because that is the year Bhopal finished hearing cases. In September 2006, the Welfare Commission for Bhopal Gas Victims announced that all original compensation claims and revised petitions had been cleared.
To this day, there are pending cases in the Indian Supreme Court to appeal for more compensation. Activists argue that because incorrect mortality numbers were used in the 1989 settlement, they deserve more now. And many gas-affected survivors, like Vishnubai, feel betrayed by the subpar quality of care from the Indian government.
Vishnubai is another survivor activist I met in JP Nagar, right across the street from the factory. She's a petite woman, less than 5 feet tall, with somber eyes that would fill up with tears every so often while she talked. It was so clear that when she spoke, she was no longer in her blue brick home, but back in 1984, reliving it all.
The gas affected at least have the gas to blame for their blindness. What excuse does the government have?
Some good, of course, did come out of the compensation. Some people were able to get treatment that they badly needed, or at least pay some of their medical bills. Some people were able to move forward with their lives, even in small ways. Nasreen B., who we introduced at the start of the episode, was one of those people.
When we befell bad times, we didn't own our house. We had a tough time getting 100 rupees together to even pay rent. Then a nearby house was selling for 15,000. So I went to my mother to ask her for the money. When I have the money, hopefully one day, then I can pay her back. At that time, I was 3 months pregnant with my son. And that's when I got 33,000 for the gas strategy. I am D-grade because I inhaled more gas. When I got that money, I gave that money to my mom. I put the money on a plate and I put flowers on top. And then I took the money over to her, decked in flowers. That's why I feel if I want to help empower someone or get something or give something, then not until the debt is repaid can someone move forward. Neither you nor them.
Apoorva had the chance to work with several non-governmental organizations during her time in India, and we'll describe those organizations in a minute. But first, here's what her take was on the differences between the types of organizations when we spoke on the phone in December of 2017.
So essentially, there are like two kinds of NGOs in Bhopal, from what I'm understanding currently. Mm-hmm. There is very much the old guard that has been around since the day the tragedy happened. Since day one, they have been, you know, they've been activists, they've been fighting for justice. But they're older, you know, like they're not that tech savvy. They do not trust foreign funding. They do not trust international interference of any kind. Mm-hmm. They believe their fight is with the Indian government, who is responsible for them. And their supporters are mostly older. Mm-hmm. They're older and poorer. You know, they've been with them since the beginning. Then there's the new guard who, I mean, when I say new, I mean they came around in the 90s. It's not like they, you know, happened yesterday.
Right.
But they didn't come around like at that time. Mm-hmm. But the new guard is very much tech savvy. Like, they know how to, they know English. They mm-hmm. know, they know how to advertise themselves. They are very much accept foreign funding because they believe that accepting money from the Indian government actually will curtail how much they can criticize the Indian government.
So Apoorva worked with three main organizations while she was there. There's the Sambhavna Clinic, which is headed by Satyanath Sarangi, who we heard from in previous episodes. He is affectionately known in the community as Satu Bhaiya, or older brother. At the Sambhavna Clinic, gas tragedy survivors receive free medical care through a variety of Eastern and Western techniques less than half a mile from the Union Carbide factory. They're what Apoorva considered one of the new guard.
Then there's the Chingari Rehabilitation Center, which I introduced in episode 3. Rashida B and her friend Champa Devi Shukla co-founded the Center for Gas Survivors' Children with Disabilities. This center is part of the New Guard too, and actually partners with Sambhavna Clinic.
And lastly, Apoorva worked with Bhopal Gas Pidit Mahila Udyog Sanghatan, which means Bhopal Female Gas Survivor Labor Union. We'll be referring to them as BGPMUS because I can probably only get that name right this one time. BGPMUS is part of the old guard. They've been around pretty much since the beginning, functioning since the tragedy in 1984, and then as an official organization a few years later. All of these organizations grew out of the movements that Rashida B, Champa Devi, Nasreen B, and so many others began decades ago. Today, they are still taking care of the survivors in their communities and advocating for long-term solutions. And every year, they commemorate the anniversary of the gas tragedy, although they do so in different ways. Here's a clip from a phone call I had with Apoorva just a few weeks after she went to some of the 33rd anniversary rallies.
So it used to be that, like, in the weeks leading up to the anniversary, it used to be this huge thing in the newspapers and all of the media, local media and international media. But now, so many years later, it has definitely pattered down. Mm-hmm. The last time that major Western media reported on the Bhopal tragedy was 3 years ago on the 30th anniversary. This year, you know, I was looking for it, so I started noticing stories like 4 days before, 3 days before, but they were always on like the fifth page, you know, it wasn't right. Like front lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up going to two rallies. Mm-hmm. The first rally was on the night of December 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
This was the Sambhavna Clinic rally. And it was a candlelight memorial. We started marching at this like historic park. We marched across one of the major roads in old Bhopal called VIP Road. We crossed this like brand new bridge. We ended in this, again, historic field called Iqbal Maidan. But it was decked in photographers. Mostly photographers, from what I could gather, were from the NGO itself. And it was obvious that they had done this many, many years now. And what this NGO and many other younger NGOs that work with this NGO understand is that what's important isn't necessarily making a big stink in the local community, but what's important is getting your message out, like out of Bhopal, out of India. But essentially, they know how to play the game.
Okay, yeah.
They know how to play the 21st century NGO game. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think they're smart.
I ended up spending more time with these newer NGOs during my time in Bhopal than I did with the old guard, like BGPMUS. But for the anniversary rallies, I found myself much more moved by BGPMUS than the new guard rallies.
So then I went to Bhopal Gas Pidit Mahila Udyog Sanghatan's rally on December 3rd, which was Sunday.
Okay.
And that was actually way larger. There were many more people there, at least 1,000.
Wow.
And this was, again, a much more standard Indian rally. They had hired this huge stage and this tent, and they had these, you know, old-looking speakers everywhere. And the crowd was very different. This crowd was much poorer than Saturday night's crowd. Mm. They were much more Muslim. There were many more survivors here. Like I said, there were 1,000 of them. And I specifically remember, like, one of the speakers I heard, I had gone with her to deliver invitations to this rally a few weeks earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say deliver invitations, I essentially mean we, like, drove around in this little auto rickshaw making announcements that the rally was happening and people should come, and we were going to, you know, update them on the status of pending court cases and et cetera, et cetera. So this woman who I had actually, you know, gone with, she has been an activist for a very long time. She herself is now, like, above the age of 60, recently had a heart surgery, like, it is herself, you know, aging, and in many ways still suffers the effects of long-term exposure to MIC gas. She begins telling the story of that night. Which is something that most all of the speakers had avoided, because everybody recognizes that everybody in the crowd has a similar harrowing tale. And so she gets up there and she starts telling the story of that night. People told her to run, so she grabbed her son and daughter and like children and started running. But then at a certain point, they realized that they were missing one of her grandchildren. So then they abandoned running and they were just going around looking for this child, and she saw these horrible things while they were looking for this child, and she remembers, instead of the child, she finds her son or her cousin who's dying, and essentially has to leave him behind because she is determined to find this child, and people were crying.
Yeah.
Like, most of the crowd had tears in their eyes. I had tears in my eyes.
The drive that motivates Amila B to tell her story year after year goes deeper than reliving the past. It is about the deeper meaning of what that memory reveals, the darker themes of humanity that Bhopal showed that continue to echo in contemporary disasters. Sethu, head of Sambhavna Clinic, who we introduced earlier, put it well.
For me, there are stuff that happen in different time periods of time that basically they raise civilizational questions, like the rise of the Third Reich. That raise questions about who are we, how are we as people, and can we become really, really evil? And the answer is yes. And stuff like that. So I think Bhopal is something like that. It exposes the true nature of corporate business. It shows that corporations would kill you, maim you, poison you for life, make you sick, just so they can make profits. And at the same time, it was like a leak in the what I would call the civilizational fantasy that, you know, that governments are there to protect you, that scientists are there who find the truth and protect, give you protection and help science, help people, and the judiciary is there to give you justice and decide what's right and what's wrong. So all that is BS, you know, at the end of the day.
I am an optimistic person, and honestly, I think in some ways, so is Sethu. Yes, the meaning of Bhopal and Bhopal's memory to him is a complete shattering of his belief in the system we live in. a complete shattering of the civilizational fantasy that someone is going to come take care of us. And yet, he has dedicated his life to this cause. He has spent decades running a free hospital in JP Nagar, planning large-scale protests, inspiring journalists and authors to share Bhopal's story. I think the deeper meaning of Bhopal is a belief in this community, a belief in this community's power, and the fundamental truth that yes, humans can be evil, but we can also be good. No individual or institution is morally absolute. We all have a Warren Anderson in us, and we all have a Satu Satrangi in us. And every day, we choose. We choose to not look away. We choose to accept that we are capable of goodness and badness. And we choose to do something about it.
You've been listening to They Knew Which Way to Run. Tune in next time to learn about what's happening in Bhopal today, a parallel crisis that was brewing under Bhopal at the same time as the gas tragedy, also the direct result of the Union Carbide factory.
We encourage you to check out our website at www.theyknewwhichwayturun.com, where you can learn more information about the tragedy, see photos of the survivors, and make a donation to NGOs on the ground still fighting for justice today. You can also read a transcript of this episode. This podcast series is written, edited, and produced by me and Molly Mulroy. Quinn Mulroy is our sound editor and associate producer.
If you liked this episode, please be sure to rate, review, and follow us. All the interviews used in our podcast were conducted by Apoorva Dixit, both independently and while working with Sambhavna Clinic and photographer Francesca Moore. Our head of marketing is Shreya Zoshi. Our transcription specialist is Avi Dixit. Our copy editor is Julia Hamilton. Our cover art was designed by Amy Zhang. Our website designer is Liliana Brusic. And all of our music is composed by Derek Renfro.
A very big thank you to everyone who supported us with this podcast and the following Bhopalis for sharing their stories for this episode. Rashida B, Shahzadi B, Nasreen B, Ashish Dixit, Karan Gupta, Bano B, Judge G.S. Patel, Vishnu Bai, and Satu Satrangi. Also, thank you to our voice actors, Rachna Dixit, Pratika Shukla, Duray Nurani, Meena Kesargad, and Garima Mishra. I'm Apoorva Dixit.
And I'm Molly Mulroy. Thank you for listening.